This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Lee Salisbury and welcome to a very special extra edition of Soap from the Box. Normally, I'm talking to soap star mates about life on and off the screen, but today I'm talking to Sophie Ellis-Bextor, someone who I've loved for many years. And over lockdown, I started listening to her podcast called Spinning Plates, and it basically gave me the inspiration to do this. Her sat with a cup of tea, having a good catch up with a mate, but talking about something really dear to her heart. So I emailed her, I don't know her, the first person on the podcast that I don't know, and she agreed to meet me and do an interview, which was amazing. And I was pretty nervous because, as I said, I'm a big fan, but we had a great chat. And this is the full interview. I can't believe I'm actually interviewing Sophie Ellis-Bextor and you're getting to listen to it. So this is amazing for me. Hope you enjoy it. And I'll give you information about the next Soap from the Box with a soap star after this. My next guest on this very special episode of Soap from the Box is not just about to take over the Queen Vic or the Rovers, I don't think.
Sophie Ellis-Bextor, hi. Probably trained somewhere.
Yeah, true. So I'll just explain to people why you're on the show, because mm-hmm. you're not running the Queen Vic or the Rovers. I listened to your podcast over lockdown, Spinning Plates, and it was kind of really inspirational for me to think, right, I could do this, as in just subjects close to your heart and also people. First of all, people that you know, friends like Fern Cotton. And then obviously you went out and kind of emailed and got other people. And I listened to your last podcast the other day where you said it gave you the kind of motivation to email people you didn't know, which is basically what I did to you.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Well, that's kind of why I wanted to speak to you as well, because I feel like it's good karma, you know, pass it on. Because, yeah, I chuck out these emails into the ether and say, hello. And I've got better, because the first few emails I'd send to people, I'd always be like, I'm sorry, and I'm sure you don't want to do this. Yeah. I'm sure you're inundated. And just forget I ever got in touch. Just ignore me.
Which I think is what I did to you. Like, just don't reply if you don't want to do it. Because it is kind of...
But it's really cringy at
this
first.
Last few months has kind of changed things like that, hasn't it? It's enabled people, I think, to think outside the box and do things they might not have done before.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's just shown there's a lot of nice people out there as well that are willing to help other people.
Definitely, and I think a lot of the sort of social structure we had in place now it doesn't really feel that relevant. I mean, I remember when it was the midst of the proper lockdown in maybe April, and I had a problem with my banking app. So I went down into Barclays and I ended up having this chat with the guy behind the desk about how, you know, how many kids he had at home and how hard he was finding it to get into work and all this, you know, and all that stuff you don't normally do, but it just felt all the sort of barriers of the normal way we interact with people and the form of that. It sort of changed so we can talk to people a bit more. Everybody relates to it because it's happened to everyone.
Yeah. And I think everyone's a bit more open now just to talk about everything, it seems. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So why did you decide? I mean, you obviously started your podcast before lockdown, didn't you? Spinning Plates. What I love about Spinning Plates is the fact that you're talking about juggling being a mum with working, and you're kind of giving yourself more work by doing a podcast.
Yeah, that's because I'm a mug.
Why did the idea come about?
I think you know what it's like when you start a project, then halfway through you kind of realise why you're doing it. It's a bit like that, really. I'm quite a sort of follow your nose kind of person. So when a friend of mine said, oh, I think you should do a podcast, at first I was like, everybody's got a bloody podcast. But then I thought, actually, maybe I can talk to some people and, you know, I start with, you know, what you know, as you say. So I thought, well, I always find I'm full of guilt and questions about how to balance my work and my home life. And of course, this became completely magnified during lockdown. I mean, how absurd. And actually, I recorded six of the first series, literally, I think, 2 weeks before lockdown, so very, very close. And then I picked up the last four just sort of when we were first allowed to see people. So it really kind of became this parenthesis for that strange bit of time. And yeah, ostensibly we're talking about being working mums, but really it's just a chance for me to have really lovely chats with some incredible women. We talk about kids maybe, but we also talk about loads of other things.
Yeah.
And I've been having these, I've realized like during lockdown, I maybe had one Zoom with some girlfriends where we had a glass of wine and had that. It didn't happen more than once. I found it a bit sad, to be honest.
Yes.
You know, it just made me feel a bit sad. But with the podcast, I can go out my house. I can say I'm doing this, recording this today. I can press record and I'm allowed like an hour and a half of a proper conversation, beginning to end, no interruptions. And it's given space and given credence. And I'm like, that is really nice.
No,
so it's actually
really
very indulgent of me.
And that's what I love listening to, I think. And that's what gave me the idea to this, just because of most of the people I'm talking to are friends as well as actors and stuff. And just, I think it's nice for people to feel like they've got a cup of tea and they're listening into a conversation between mates, but they're also kind of learning about a whole new walk of life. Do you know what I mean? For me, because a lot of people find our industry very kind of detached, so I like the fact that they can feel a bit more involved with the people that they like.
And it's relatable, isn't it? A lot of people when they go home and they're not doing that, going on with getting on with the same old stuff, so it's kind of, it's nice to sort of peek behind the curtain of that, I guess.
So normally the podcast is obviously talking to people who are in soap, so I normally divide it into their life, and but this I'm just throwing everything up in the air and kind of doing a mixtape of questions for you. So let's start with the recent, which is the Kitchen Disco, which has kind of like gone crazy now, but what it kind of got me and so many people through lockdown, I think. Everyone looked forward to Friday, and so many people I know listened to it who weren't even maybe fans of yours before. But it was that kind of feeling of like, this is something we can look forward to every week. Do you know what I mean? It was a, what, how did it come about?
Well, it definitely helped us remember what day of the week it was, but I think, like everybody, really, when lockdown first happened, I felt completely discombobulated. I felt pretty useless. I felt like I didn't really know what to prioritise, what to be doing, you know, other than, you know, the domestic stuff. I was just thinking, you know, my Instagram and social media seemed to be full of people baking sourdoughs and exercising and learning
a
language.
And I was thinking, Carol Warneman did maths, I think.
Yeah. And I was feeling like, I understand that that's a wonderful way to fill time you're not expecting to have, but I can't find the way to do it for myself. You know, I'm struggling to hear myself think in amongst, you know, having mostly very young kids in the house. And I thought, ah, damn it, I'm not a very accomplished musician. I can't accompany myself on piano. I can't play guitar. So I felt really useless. And then Richard said, why don't we just do a gig? Like, we'll just live stream a gig from the house. And I was like, that's bonkers, you know? I've got like literally a baby crawling along the floor. Like, how on earth is that going to work? And so we did the first gig and I put on my sequin cat suit and I was like, okay, here we are. And I really thought people were going to laugh at me or say, oh my God, what was that? Like, that lady's gone mad. And actually the feedback we got was really warm, really, really warm. And the interesting thing was as well for Richard and I, is it gave us the same thing in our heads as if we'd done a real gig. We kind of got that same
buzz and that same euphoria. Yeah.
Which is really unexpected.
And was it nice to dress up? Even like doing the job, do you know what I mean? Like going and putting
all
the
of
outfit
it.
On and making yourself up.
Literally all of it. And, you know, also if I have a task, if I'm allowed the space for that task, and because I knew that it was important to Richard and I, but also important to the people that we were, the little community we found ourselves in, you know, on a Friday at 4 o'clock, it'd be like, right, we're going to move out the stuff out the playroom, and then I'll go upstairs while the kids are having supper, I'll put my makeup on, and, you know, you prioritize it because it was given space, it is allowed to take that space. So I loved it. It was like so good for my head. And my eldest is quite, he's quite clever with his observations, and he said to me one day, you know, Mum, you do realise you're kind of ranting during the songs and like using it as a place to like let things out. And I was like, actually, you're right. I thought it was escapism, but it's actually catharsis. I'm just like ranting and raving about all the crap that's gone on this week.
Exercising that week's demons.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yep, still at home. I'm just, you know, I'm taking a tour of my kitchen. This is a bit weird. You know, my kids are here, needs a cart, my phone's got broken, we can't do any homeschooling.
Yeah.
At least we've got alcohol and music, so. Yeah.
And like you said, like before all of this mad year happened, people probably would, if you had suddenly done that, people have been like, what the hell is this? Was it kind of ever questionable in your head to let people into your home and stuff? I mean, you're quite private, aren't you? So it's,
I am.
Was that kind of big deal? No.
You know what, it wasn't, but the reason was because it's like when you're saying like people who weren't fans of me were watching that. Actually, I didn't feel like I was doing it as kind of like, oh, it's me and my day job performing.
Yeah.
I felt like, what do I do? What's the thing I find helps me as a good tonic when I'm feeling wobbly? And it's always been music.
Yeah.
And so in our house, we constantly have music on. You know, my toddler is obsessed with dancing and music. So it's just played around the house all the time. And it cheers us up and it gets us through the day and it sets the tone. And if there's a bit of tension, we put on music to sort of alleviate that. It's, you know, we very much have a soundtrack going on. So it felt more like that. Like, this is how our family cope with a lockdown and with, you know, all the stuff that's been going on. And it was just nice that it kind of seemed to resonate with people, really.
Yeah, totally.
And it meant so much to me, honestly. I used to read through all the comments and, you know, I loved it. And I made new friends, acquaintances after it, which was really lovely too.
It just captured the imagination and made people feel kind of a sense of warmth. Because I know in television, we realised everyone wanted to watch programmes that have been on for years or reruns. They wanted the comfort and they wanted...
Definitely.
So even though your thing was new, it was almost like then became a comfort blanket every week. Like you said, because you just knew it was Friday and time to have a drink.
Yeah, and singing old songs. I know, singing like stuff from like my childhood and songs from like musicals and just really delving into my proper like feel good, you know. I'm feeling sad. Where's Julie Andrews?
And how did you? Yeah, because I was going to say Julie Andrews and probably the Madonna song did so well.
Oh,
like,
I
did
love
you,
that. That's one of my favourite songs of all time.
And did you find it easy to pick songs then? Did you just literally...
Loved it.
Because normally you don't do covers, I suppose, as well. So was it great?
I do, though. Actually, I love doing a cover. Covers are brilliant. And at first I was doing covers of songs I'd already sung before. So I was like messaging producers I hadn't worked with for a while and saying, oh, do you remember we did a cover of, you know... Like one of them was crying at the discotheque, actually.
Yes, which is one of my favourite songs
ever.
Yeah,
it's brilliant, isn't it? So things like that, I was like kind of delving, like, what have I done a cover of?
Yeah.
And then I discovered all the karaoke backing tracks on iTunes. And I thought, oh, they're a bit rubbish. And then I did one week and actually, like, everybody was fine with it. So I thought, okay, now it's open season. I can literally do anything. And even now, I've got a list in my phone of songs I'd like to do. And no, performing covers is just... joyful. I adore it.
And you released Crying at the Discotheque. Have you just gone in and recorded that properly now? Or
So I've done a new version of that with these producers called Jules and Stone, who I used to work with a lot in my sort of like my second, third, fourth album around that sort of time. The album is basically a collection of singles which I haven't put in one place before, but also I put quite a lot of covers in there, so like True Faith and as a pulp cover. There's like over 20 songs on that record. So yeah, that's been really fun to put together too.
And what music did you kind of grow up listening to? Who were your inspirations when you were young?
Well, probably all the people I sang.
All the people you sang now, yeah.
You know, when I was really little, it was kind of cross-section of like weirdness because my mum and my dad were quite influential, but they liked, so my mum gave me things like Paul Simon and probably introduced me to things like Sound of Music and Grease and stuff like that. My dad gave me Pink Floyd and Beatles and The Doors and Who and things like that. And then by myself, I was kind of really into pop. So Tony Basil and David Bowie and Madonna and Prince and, you know, when I got older, En Vogue and Linda Carlisle. And, yeah, just like, I was like, yeah, honestly, just cramming in. But all the stuff I liked when I was little, I still really love. So like, Ballroom Blitz, which I used to, you know, bop about to when I was in single digits, I still adore. It's like everything kind of, I just keep adding to the pile. I got asked the other day about what my guilty pleasure song, and I just really don't agree with that term at all. Like, I don't feel guilty about any of the songs
at all.
I like.
Oh,
if it's
God,
a good
no.
song, it's a good song. It's fine.
And then it's gone on to do, obviously, you've done a Radio 2 show now, Kitchen Disco, and you're going on tour with the Kitchen Disco. So what can people expect from the Kitchen Disco kind of on tour? Is it, how do you kind of translate your kitchen to a stage?
I think I've got to literally build a kitchen.
I know, I think you're going to have to.
Yeah, so I kind of, I like the idea of having the window seat.
And will your kids be on tour with you all night?
No. No.
Did they enjoy it, by the way? Did they love it?
They did, actually. And I think, again, you know, you're talking about privacy and all, I think context is everything. So for them, even though Richard and I knew that we were broadcasting and people watching, for them, they were only ever watching their mum singing to the back of their dad's phone. And it was very much, you know, relaxed, and I had my microphone was going direct into Richard's phone so that people could hear me singing, but I could hear what was really happening, like the kids asking, like, I'm hungry, he hit me, you know.
Well, I might be able to get changed. One of them nearly let off like some kind of firework into you. Magical bits, I think. I think people were thinking, oh my God, this is like, she's got five kids, this is mad, but also going, oh my God, if she can do this, we can do, I can cope at home with my two children.
It was fun, but it was chaos. Like,
yeah,
you know,
that was the funness.
And every week I was always very nervous about, is this the one where someone's going to hurt themselves or something's going to happen that's really bad? And then I just think, look, if something goes wrong, we just stop, you know, it's not, I don't have to. see it through to the end just because I've, you know, it's for fun. It's
yeah,
for fun.
Yeah. And like you said, you're a musician. Well, I think anyone that works in the arts, it is that frustration when you can't do, and there's two of you. Mm. So does that make it 10 times worse? Because I know I'm married to someone out of television. I went out with lots of people in television. It was too much, like having two people.
Yeah.
It makes it like, so do you find that hard, you two, in a way that you're both?
You know what? Not really, because I think it works quite well having me. I'm a front person on stage, so I'm more of an extrovert on stage, but actually socially I'm more introverted. Then we're sort of the flip of that. So Richard, as a bass player, he's used to his role in the band being like sort of keeping it grounded,
yeah,
and locking in the rhythm. And then socially he's more, you know,
the front man.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it kind of works quite well like that, really. And I like the fact that he knows what my work is, and also he works really closely with, we're both very involved in each other's projects if it's appropriate.
Yeah.
So like with my podcast, he does all my editing because, you know, lockdown, I was like, hey, yeah.
That we both got someone doing our editing.
Yeah, yeah. He's done absolutely loads of work for me, poor thing. And then
and do you realise we're doing the podcast? I listen to myself back and realise I say the same, like I say all the time.
Yeah, I don't really listen to it back.
Don't so
that's,
you?
That's my recommendation.
That's the magic,
for that.
Just put it out.
Yeah, God, I mean, I love what other people say, but yeah, I don't understand why we're so predisposed to hate the sound of our own voices.
I know, it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, what is that?
And there's something with voices, because I always got told that, like, when you lose someone, when someone dies, and if you think of it now, you can't ever think of their actual voice, which is true.
That's a sad
if you try to think of someone, you can't actually think of how they sound like, but we're so preoccupied with our own, voice. I don't know what we think we sound like, but we always sound 10 times differently when we listen back to ourselves.
Yeah, definitely.
Is that the same as singing? It can't be the same as singing. Because I suppose singers and actors are kind of similar in the way that actors have to go on and just, you know, like I always say to actors, like if you have to do, say, a love scene, it's not, they have to go, it's not me, it's that character, and they have to be able to put themselves in that. And I suppose, like you said, as a singer, you get up on stage and you just, is it kind of like a Sophie Ellis Bextor, the singer, and has to come out to...
You know what? I think when I was younger, maybe, but the older I get, the more, there's less of a gap between me on stage and me off stage, really. I think I've become a lot more relaxed with myself, and I've worried so much less about what people think.
Yeah, I think that's the thing as you get older, isn't it?
You know, I mean, no, I think you could probably see just from the kitchen disco, really. I'll be chatting and then singing and then chatting, and it's not, there's less and less of a gap. I've really enjoyed that. For me, it's been really nice to sort of take that further. In fact, funnily enough, you know, before we start recording, we were talking about GAY, and it was actually a GAY performance that kind of changed my performing, really, because when I was first starting, I was so nervous and so shy, and I used to stand very, very still when I was performing. And even when I did Groove Jet, which is like a proper dance record, I was like, I'm not going to dance, you know, I'm just going to stay really still. And it felt appropriate to me then. I felt quite guarded, and I quite liked the fact that I was doing something a bit different because it protected me from being compared to other people. So I was like, I'll just stay still and hold my own. But as I got older, you know, my inhibition sort of, you know, shifted. You don't care so much. And then I did a GAY, which was my first performance back after I'd had my first baby. So maybe he was maybe like three or something. And I just went on stage and I was like, oh my God, I just don't care that much anymore like that. And it was lovely because I felt like so much more connected to the crowd and the moment and everything. So it really changed my life a little bit, really. So yeah, no, I don't really feel like I do put on a hat of like, okay, no, I'm a singer.
Yeah.
I feel like my job when I sing is to tell the story and to open that box. But I've sort of learned how to do that better within my head, I think.
And I think I remember because I worked in kids' television, The Saturday Show, and you were on that quite a few times.
Oh, yeah,
and that was the time of kind of, it was very popular. It was Steps and Hearsay and all of that. And I remember on your podcast, when you talked to Mylene Klass, you talked about being on the tour bus with like Hearsay and Danny Bedingfield and feeling quite isolated because it was very in your face, like everyone doing big, you know, everyone was out. So I remember at the time thinking you stood apart. It must have been quite hard to be within that mix of pop, I suppose, at the time, but you did so well because I think, but was it quite hard being in a like a record stable of those people where
I think I found the pop tag at that time was used as a way to sort of make you try and put you down a bit, really. And I kept saying, but pop's responsible for some of my favorite things ever, you know, a lot of what David Bowie has done and, you know, Prince and everything that would come under that term. I mean, obviously there's lot of different strands, different genres, but some of it's very poppy, just pure melodic 3.5 minute songs. And so I felt like pop was sort of used as a bit of a dirty word. And I think because I'd come from an indie band before that and then done a dance record, my journey to being a sort of pop star was quite different, really,
to everyone else.
And so I felt like I needed to carry with me the things about those things I'd loved and why I'd wanted to do them. And And also, I kind of wanted to not feel like anyone was going to tell me, like, oh, we think you should wear more denim and get fringe. But to be honest, I think some of that was in my head as well. And I was like 21 when I brought out my first album. And I think I was very caught up in what people thought. And
which everyone is. And anyone listening to this, I would say, who's younger, you realise, don't you, so much as you get older that, you know, you do care so much less about what people think.
And it's
you,
one of the untold joys of getting older.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? Because you just care so much at the beginning. I always say, look, you know, if you join EastEnders now, if you're 18, you know, it changes your life. And also it's really hard age to join because you care so much. And obviously you, at that height of that pop fame then, social media wasn't around. I mean, do you think things would have been 10 times different if social media was, you know, worried about so much what you think about?
Yeah, I think it would have been harder to leave things behind as well. I love the fact that a lot of the things I learned were sort of slightly more under the radar, to be honest.
Yes, yeah.
You know, you'd have to really hunt around, I think, to find a lot of my like early interviews and performances and all that. And that's been quite nice for me, to be honest. I don't want to be confronted with a lot of that. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think the social media thing is sort of finding its feet a little bit more now. But I think that in its infancy, it was probably a really, it felt a lot more like clunky trying to marry it up with music. And record companies definitely didn't know the significance of it.
What to do, no, or nor did television companies. And I just think at the time, again, it fed into that thing of wanting to be loved. It was how many followers you could get for people. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of was adding even more into that.
Exactly.
Which is quite crazy. And now I think hopefully people are coming out the other side of it.
Yeah.
But how has the music industry changed? Because back then I remember like S Club 7, you know, like they'd have their heads held up as they were having their makeup done because they were so shattered. They're being flown around the world. I'm not sure if it was the same as you, but have things changed, do you think, in the music industry over the years? I mean, obviously they have changed over the years, but it seems now that you can do a lot more yourself rather than
I think it depends completely on the artist, what's going on at the time, the opportunities, the management, the team around, all that kind of thing. I mean, I watched the Avicii documentary last night that's on BBC
iPlayer. I've seen that.
And, you know, and he was very much at the mercy of management, just not really hearing him say over and over and over again, I'm not doing this and I can't really do this anymore. That's hard watch, I found. So no, I think that's definitely down to like the management, the people who are listening to you, who's caring about you, what you prioritize. I think by and large, generally speaking, if you're caught up in the momentum of something and something's been put out into the world and you've got all these opportunities, you're probably going to want to take them. And so that is quite daunting. And I know when my first album came out and, you know, Murder on the Dance Floor was everywhere and I felt like really freaked out by
I know, because you had that, I suppose. You had one of those songs that just took off hugely.
It did. I mean, it's exciting, but I was also very much thinking, you know, I'd look at my diary and I'd think, this isn't my own choice. You know, I've just got no days off for weeks on end. But I think, you know, people still, your instinct as a, if you get those opportunities to take them, and that's fine.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is that generally speaking, record companies really are very happy if they have quite a self-sufficient artist. They don't want to create extra work for themselves. So if you're someone that says, I can write my own songs, I can produce my own stuff, I know how, what I want to wear, and
amazing.
I'm going to direct my video, they'll go, great, well, that's brilliant. So I think, you know, they're all for that input. So I don't think record companies are necessarily this kind of evil beast trying to control everything. They'll just get involved where they can if they need to. But then if that's when it can go a bit wobbly as well, because then you've suddenly got like a committee of people all deciding what should be happening.
Yeah, because in the end, I suppose you are a product in a way as well, aren't you?
Well, absolutely. And it's art as commerce, and art and commerce are always going to be slightly uneasy bedfellows, really.
Totally.
And you're always going to be fighting in one corner. But, you know, in a weird way, I had 10 years at Universal and I made some really good friends there. And even though there was a lot about it, I was kicking against, in a weird way, it kind of suited me to be kicking against it. It's a bit like school. It's a bit like being at school.
You're always going to kick against, aren't you?
You think, you know, it was quite nice to be able to moan about my major label.
Yeah.
Because they also gave me some amazing times. I mean, I flew all around the world. There's no way I could have done that if I had an independent label, my, you know, funding it myself, whatever. So I feel like in a way I kind of got to have the best of both worlds, because I had a decade of making all those inroads and experiencing all that and learning so much. And then when I left Universal, I was like, okay, this is like the equivalent of leaving a company and being given like a really nice pen or something.
Yes, yeah.
Like I'm going to set
up. Or it's like before you get married, it's like you've now realised what you need, all the experience.
Yeah, it feeds in.
And how's it changed with like, you mentioned music videos, because music videos, obviously like Madonna, we talked about, was, you know, instrumental in changing the face of music videos, really. They're not, are they important anymore? I don't know. They're not, are
I don't
they?
Think they have the no. same weight, to be honest. No, I think,
like, do you need to make a music video or no?
I would probably say no, not really. I think if you're a big, shiny, very successful band or pop star, it's probably still something that fans would get really would want. But music television doesn't have the same some currency it did. It's now social media and digital and streaming and radio.
Well, the idea, because I remember the Saturday Show and Live and Kicking before that, it was like if the artist was on that, they would like climb the charts by loads. Yeah. Like, it's weird how not in that much time things have totally and utterly changed.
But that's also as well because at that time when those Saturday programmes were on, music was still very much part of sort of a bedrock of youth culture.
Yeah, so totally.
Kids wanted to watch perform. I mean, music is still there, but it's shifted the emphasis of where they're accessing it and how they enjoy it. You know, kids don't watch terrestrial telly and get up on a Saturday morning going, I better drag my duvet downstairs and watch, telly.
Well, they don't really watch anything timed, do they? I mean, it's literally like everything's on demand. Yeah,
and that's exactly how they want to have their music as well. You know, even my one-year-old can say, like, Alexa,
oh my god, that's amazing.
Yeah, because he knows, like, got this, you know, mystery voice in the kitchen and...
Yeah, whereas mine still doesn't work for me.
Really?
Oh, god, I'm rubbish with it.
Oh,
I'm
does she not
really old.
Get your voice or something?
No, yeah, maybe now I've got the podcast she will.
It starts to feel a bit personal after a while.
I know, yeah. Did growing up, obviously your mum was, again, I loved your mum growing up watching Blue Peter. You know, that must have shaped you in some form and in your view of the industry and how you thought about it. Did it make you want it more? Did it make, I've never, never
it's hard that. For me to be objective. I mean, my mum started, she was acting on telly from when I was like six months old.
Yeah, wow.
You know, Blue Peter came along when I was four. And so between when I was 4 to 8, that's what she was doing. So I don't know if I was really actively aware of, like, oh, this is really shaping me.
No. But did you have, like, kids? What was it like basically having your mum being on telly? So, I mean, did you?
Yeah, quite surreal, really, because I think for the first bit, I thought that's just what everybody's mum did. And then as I was going through primary school, I realised, oh, actually, this is just me. And then initially that was quite a cool currency. And I'd be like, oh, my mum's famous. She's on Blue Peter. And people go, wow. And they'd want to be my friend. And then they'd quickly be like, actually, that's quite annoying that you've pointed that out. Well, we don't really want to be friends with you. So I kind of had a, you know, yin and yang. Yeah. Normally it was within about 10 minutes of meeting someone new. But I definitely think, I suppose the thing my parents did that was really great, because my dad worked in telly too, is they both had really creative jobs and I grew up in quite creative households. And so thinking along those lines and getting excited about creative ideas was really always given, you know, it was allowed to be a priority to you. But I think I also kicked against telly. I didn't really want to be involved in telly.
Yeah.
So for me, music was a perfect place for me to create my own space. And they didn't necessarily know. I could tell them what was going on rather than them tell me. And
yeah,
I used to like that.
Yeah. And everyone should listen to it. Your interview with your mum is really great on your podcast.
Oh, thank you.
And it's quite great that she felt quite guilty, actually, about, she thought she spent too much time
I didn't really know that at the time. I mean, we were very close for, you know, it's literally just my mum and I for about three years. So that was a very intense little time in a way. It's funny because I don't think about Blue Peter at all now. Obviously, it was like decades ago. Except that I think a year and a half ago, they had a big birthday for Blue Peter's 60th birthday. And I was booked to sing on the show. And my mum was booked to come and do some filming for it. And so they had it all in Manchester and they had as many Blue Peter presenters as were around. So I don't know how many there were, but definitely, you know, in the tens.
Like, yeah.
Loads and loads of Blue Peter presenters in one place. And I found that really weird.
Weird.
Yeah, because it was so inherent to me. Like, even the theme tune, if I heard it now, I'd be like, you know. It's sort of, you know, it's sort of almost part of my DNA. So that felt really strange. Like, oh, I'm a grown up, but this is all
really
so
surreal.
Yeah, but like a place in my head I don't often go.
But it's the same as soap. So what's weird about working in soap is, especially with the first time we go to like the Soap Awards, is that I was there with Emmerdale, but like everyone's there from EastEnders, Coronation Street. And it is surreal because
that must feel very weird.
Even if you don't watch soap, it's part of our makeup. Like TV in this country, isn't it?
Yeah, so, I used to watch soaps. I used to like, they're very comforting.
Which one did you watch?
EastEnders,
yeah.
Yeah, I used to watch it on the bus. Days, on the Sunday.
Days.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Have you ever been?
No.
And that was, so when I started.
Actually, you know what? Did it used to be next to where Pop of the Pops was?
Yes, Ballroom Woods. Yeah,
I think I did maybe wander into Albert Square.
Because what I used to love there, and I always tell this story, is you used to go into the canteen, awful canteen, but you used to have, like, say, you sat there or Cher, and then someone from Holby City dripping with blood, a couple of kids in their uniform from Grange Hill, and Doc Cotton in the corner.
Yeah,
it was like the most surreal, brilliant, weird way into telly.
I do remember that, actually.
So I was actually talking of famous kids and parents. Normally what I do on the podcast is kind of test people about their characters. So I just thought I'd choose some people who've got famous parents, and you have to guess the famous parent. Well, okay. Quite easy, to be honest. Enrique.
Oh, yeah, Julio.
Kim Wilde.
Didn't even need a surname.
No.
Kim Wilde, his Marty Wilde.
Marty Wilde, yeah. What I love about Kim and people like that, there's a big influx at the moment of people coming back, isn't there? Mm. Like bands and singers coming back and kind of reinventing themselves again.
Well, I've watched Kim Wilde perform live, and she's brilliant.
She was amazing, yeah.
Really
and Belinda
good.
Carlisle, that you said, oh, I went and saw Belinda. Her, and she was incredible.
Yes, and actually Belinda tweeted me a couple of times
Did
about
she?
The kitchen discos, and I was like, honestly, if it's only been for that,
that's
like,
amazing.
It's worth it. Because I was on, I love Belinda Carlisle so much, and I had all her albums when I was growing up, and I listened to all the songs, and I think she's great.
I was dreading going to see her because I thought, is it going to be like, you know, someone? And she was just still her. She was absolutely incredible. Did Madonna didn't get in touch then after?
Madonna, no. I mean, I have a complicated relationship with Madonna because I love her. Like, she was honestly such an idol to me when I was growing up. I thought I was the biggest Madonna fan ever. But then I think when I got older, I was a bit confused by some of the things she put out and the way she did it. I still find her a fascinating musician. And she's, I think the thing about her that's been really underrated actually is her songwriting. She's heavily involved creatively with the songs she sings, and she's done some incredible songs. I mean, I personally think Like a Prayer is one of the most perfect pop records.
It's one of the best songs ever. Yeah, it is.
But she's written so many good songs. And I think, you know, people don't really give her the credit for that. And she's a phenomenal performer. But yeah, I went to see her live at the Madame X shows.
I heard.
I found it
weird. Things.
I loved some of it. I loved, and other parts of it, I thought I didn't quite understand the artistic statement. But I'll always be someone that supports her.
Well, I just think it's amazing. She's, you know, to have longevity in this world as a musician or in the arts is incredible. And she's managed to always kind of find those new ways of doing things. Or she's always wanted to create controversy, which I kind of like and dislike in the same way. But
she's actually really smart. I mean, that was one thing that came across with the Madame X shows, is she was sort of chatting about politics and, you know, being properly sort of on the money and funny and all those sorts of things. So I find her like she's
one of the people I think I would dread meeting, because I think I would be so scared.
Yeah, but I think that's quite cool as well?
I know, though. It is really cool.
It's quite good to be scary, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd love it if people were frightened of me sometimes.
Apparently, I listened to a journalist talking. She was from Vogue or something. She said literally she got put in this chair in her house for like 3 hours while she waited for it to come down.
Wow.
I know. And then the first thing she was like, she was just tiny. But yeah, mad. Just some other people. I didn't realise this one. Angelina Jolie.
Oh, well, I know. I can see his face immediately in my head, her actor father.
Oh, you know them,
But what's his name?
John Voight.
Yeah,
I didn't never know.
They don't have a very happy relationship, I don't think.
Oh, don't they?
I don't think
okay. I never realised that at all. And I didn't realise this either, which is so obvious. Dakota Johnson.
Isn't she Melanie Griffiths
and Don Johnson? Yeah, never realised that. So just going back, talking of telly and acting, this I found amazing that you did Game of Thrones. You got cut.
I didn't get cut.
Oh, you didn't get cut? No.
No, I didn't actually. I think that was misconstrued because I said I said you won't see us.
Ah.
Meaning because they were like, I don't know how many thousand extras.
Yeah.
And it was also quite dark.
So how did that come about?
Richard is a really, really big Game of Thrones fan. He'd watched it from the very beginning. I joined from about series 4 or 5 and I really enjoyed it. But I think for him, it was always, you know, he'd been there since, you know, the very beginning of the show.
He's like, this is mine.
Yeah, yeah. He loves it. And he introduced me to it. So we watched the last few series and got really into it. And we sometimes have friends over to watch it with us. You know, it was really fun. And then he bumped into someone from a band, and I'm trying to remember who it was. It might have been someone from Bastille or... Yeah, I think it was Bastille. And they'd been on the show.
Oh, wow.
And he was chatting to them about it. And basically, I wrote to... I've got an agent that sort of does sort of TV and, you know, sort of acting maybe thick jobs sort of under that banner. And I messaged her and I just said, can you just see... I'll just say to them, I would love to be an extra if there's any way of doing it. I don't know how this works, but I'm here.
Yeah.
I'll get myself over to Belfast and I'll do it. And she wrote back going, yep, they've said,
oh my God,
great. That's so I was like, oh my God, this is really going to happen. And then they cancelled that day and I was like, oh no. And then they went, okay, yeah. And then it happened the second time. So Richard and I had this crazy little trip.
He must have absolutely loved it.
Yeah, but we both did. It was really fun.
I've seen the pictures. I mean, you were properly like,
yeah, yeah, we turned up. Out. It's so funny because they've been filming where they filmed for absolute years now. I think it might even be 10 years in this location in Belfast. So there's a whole sort of community, economy of people that are all connected with the show, yes, and being extras. Yeah, yeah. And they've been extras from the beginning. So if you're walking around Belfast, you see these sort of tall blokes with like long hair and long beards, and they're probably Game of Thrones extras. And so, you know, I was chatting to some of the extras and one guy's like, yeah, I've died, you know, 6 times. And, you know, some of them are very particular about, actually, she shouldn't be holding that one because that kind of dragon glass would only kill certain type of White Walker,
right,
or whatever. You
my
know,
God.
They're quite sort of on it with the facts of Game of Thrones. But it was just really fun. And we just hung out and met some of the leads. And we were kind of given this sort of very lovely, like almost like a VIP extra experience.
Yeah.
I mean, we felt very jammy. They kind of really looked after us. And I think they'd had some chess world champion the night before and they were about to have some American football star the next day. And I think they do it as well. They did it because it was such a long shoot, such long days. The ones we were doing was the night shoot of filming. So, you know, we sort of start at 8 p.m. We finished at like 3 or 4 in the morning. And that had been going on for weeks. They did 6 weeks of filming that one big battle in the third episode of the last series. So I think they had extras to kind of keep the morale of everybody around as well, because it gave a little bit of something to talk about. So I think that's why they were letting people come in and dress up. And
that's amazing, though. What an experience.
Yeah, I loved it.
My husband's been in everything. So he was...
he's an extra.
He's not an extra, no. But I just dragged him in to be on it because I was like, this would be great for you. So I cut him from EastEnders. He had to ask Phil for a car, and he was a policeman in Emmerdale. And yeah. Mm. Have you got any kind of acting bug? Do you kind of, is it something you'd like to do?
It's what I thought I'd do when I was a teenager.
Because you've done a short film and stuff, haven't you?
I've done bits and bobs over the years. And when I was a teenager, I did National Youth Theatre and like any local play. I was really hungry for it and I loved the idea of it, but to be honest, it was always, I felt like when I started singing, I took the elements of acting that I'd loved and I took the music I loved and it sort of found my own space with it. But if you'd asked me at 14 what I wanted to be, I would have said actor. So
you wouldn't, you can't see yourself going to the West End? Well, hopefully going, no.
I don't really see it because I'm so impressed with anyone that does that. I think it's a really different discipline. The commitment is often really intense.
Oh, yeah.
A friend of mine, he was doing West End shows and he said the first couple of weeks are really, really hard. But then after that, your voice almost gets in this place where you can just sing anything
right,
the whole time
okay.
because you've sort of got it into this really amazing place. So I think that would be fun. But I once had a meeting actually about doing a musical and I was intrigued. So I went along for the meeting with the producer and at the end of it, he said, out of 10, how keen are you on doing this? And I said, 7 or 8.
Yeah.
And he said, don't do it unless you're 10.
Right,
because it'll take so much from you. But unless you're starting out of like 10 out of 10, I want to do this, don't. And it was a really good bit of advice, actually. And I thought, and I appreciated him doing that very much because I thought you've kind of given me permission as well to say, okay, I'm not quite there.
I like your podcast because that would be spinning plates. That would be incredibly hard having kids as well, you know, because it's a totally different lifestyle.
It's also just not really what I want for myself. No. I mean, I think if the right thing was there, I think when work is right and you love it, like when I did Strictly, that's kind of the equivalent, I guess. Like that was very intensive. It lasted for nearly 4 months. I was working all the time, 6 days a week. You know, I was really committed to it and a lot of learning and all this. And I let myself do that because I'm really
immersed in
I thought
really wanted
it's
to.
A one-off and it's unique and fun. And what the heck, I'm never going to do
this
again.
Can you still get up at like a wedding and do a proper... That's why I'd love
no
to
one's
do Strictly.
Ever asked me
to
do a waltz.
To learn all of those dances.
I did love all that. But I mean, I suppose the musical thing for me would be the same thing. Like if someone said it's Guys and Dolls, I think I'd find that hard to turn down because I adore that musical.
Yeah.
But I'm probably getting a bit old to be Adelaide these days.
And then one other thing I wanted to talk to you about was Song Diaries, the album, because that's incredible, I think.
Thanks.
Got songs re-recorded. I mean, was that amazing for you to listen to? I mean, how did that come about, really? The idea of Murder on the Dance Floor kind of being done with an orchestra.
It did feel a little bit like a moment of madness. And I suppose as well, it's a kind of It's quite funny because obviously, and I've done the Kitchen Discos album, which is like the sort of pure version of everything. Which obviously, you know, was a sort of reaction to what's happened in my life. But when I did the Song Diaries, I was at a point where a lot of people were saying about greatest hits, and I just thought, I don't really feel like I know why I'd be doing that right now. I really want to do something a bit more challenging. So I've got a friend of mine called Amy, who's a cellist, but also an arranger. And I took her out for lunch and I was like, I'd love to do all my songs, all my singles orchestrally.
Amazing.
If you'll do it. She's like, great. But it was a bit like a sort of grand designs project, as I always think of it, because, you know, there's no cheap way to make a sort of massive orchestral album, particularly if you're like, actually, no, it does need harp. Oh, no, it does need timpani. So I was literally just adding bells and whistles onto everything. And it was glorious and I loved it. But it was halfway through, I was a bit like, oh, crap. Because it's a bit like planning a big build, construction site.
Yes.
So you kind of get everybody, you know, get all the builders in.
You've got your budget and you're like, right, we're definitely sticking to this.
And then you make your kitchen first and you spend a little bit more money than you meant to in the kitchen. And you're like, well, now the kitchen looks all incredible. I have to make the rest of the house match.
Yeah.
It's a bit like that, really. So.
And did you go in for the, do you remember the first day hearing like your songs play? That must be
like total
incredible
goosebumps.
Yeah.
And actually the biggest gift I got from that record was that I then toured with an orchestra.
Wow.
I have this amazing guy that called Ollie Rosenblatt, who basically took a punt on me, and it really, I really appreciated it, because I was trying to work out how to do the album live, and my world is very much normally the sort of traditional rock and roll world, those kind of venues, those kind of promoters, my agent, all that sort of stuff. So, you know, if you're looking at performing with, I don't know, even a 10-piece string section and a band and performing at those sort of level of gigs, it's just very hard to make it make sense economically. Yeah. And then you think, well, what's the point of doing an orchestral record if you're then going out on tour and with a band and four string players or something?
Yeah.
It's not one thing or another. So we're really stuck. And a friend of mine on Facebook said, oh, well, my other half, actually, he puts on orchestral tours. So I phoned him up for some advice, and he ended up saying, I'm going to do this with you.
Wow.
So he booked the festival hall, Royal Festival Hall, a 40-piece orchestra. And then I sort of filled in all the gaps. And I had this extraordinary night. And I was like 6 months pregnant with my fifth baby, sung with this incredible orchestra. And it was honestly like one of my favorite gigs of all time. I just was in heaven. And then he said, right, we'll do a tour of it. So we went from playing these very much these sort of rock and roll venues to playing places like the Palladium and all these beautiful theatres up and down the country, places that were built in Victorian times and before, and just incredible, you know, places that are designed for orchestras. And, you know, I suddenly was on tour with over 20, you know, orchestral classical musicians and my band. So the first half of the gig would be very, you know, grown up. I have a conductor, a friend of mine, Elliot. I'd walk out and I'd sing with the orchestra for like maybe eight or nine songs. And then my band would come out and we'd do disco, but with the orchestra.
Wow.
And I was, every night I was like, this is where I want to be. And I just adored it. It was so beautiful. And the orchestra sounded so lovely. And I took Mickey on tour with me because he was born by then. So he was, you know, 4 months old.
Orchestras are just, have you ever seen one of the Pete Tong kind of nights where they, which are incredible as well, the orchestra. Like your favourite, like Ibiza tunes.
Yeah.
An orchestra is absolutely incredible.
Well, that's basically what we did, except that rather than DJing the songs, we had a band, live band doing that as well.
So have you always had the same band with you? Have you had the band for years?
Pretty much. And Richard's in my band, my husband. That's how we met.
I didn't realize that.
When we first started dating, he wasn't in my band because he was doing The Feeling very intensively, his band. And also we felt like maybe we needed to sort of, we're a couple, we should probably do this separately. And then when I did my first album independently, which is a record called Wanderlust, which was really folky, he was really supportive of that and got back involved with helping me sort of support me through the recording process and, you know, bit, you know, helping with production and all this kind of thing. So after that, I was like, well, you've got to tour it. And we've been touring together ever since, actually. And I love it. I love it.
And that's what I love about your music, because like that was folky. And then I love the dance, but there's a kind of a whole remix version of that, which is one of my favourite. That's absolutely amazing. Thanks. That's what I love about you experimenting. And it's that, do you have to fight for that to be able to do something? No, it just comes. And it's amazing, though, that I think that you can organically do that and people have followed.
I'm very
fortunate. Brilliant. Yeah.
But I think you know what it's like. The more experience you have, the more you start to learn what makes you tick. And I realised that I actually quite like being a bit scared and doing things that are a bit challenging. And the lovely thing about making Wanderlust, which I paid for completely myself, was that it didn't matter. I said to my manager, I'm going to make this record. And commercially, I have no idea what it's going to do.
Yeah.
and it'll probably not do anything because I've done dance up to now and pop, and you know, this might not be what people want from me, but I just feel like it's exactly what I need to do for me. And so I made this record thinking, you know, I'll just make really selfish decisions for like the first time ever, really.
Yeah, which is great.
And I made it with friends, and then it did end up actually being very, it did a lot better than we were expecting. And it was like, ah, that's actually taught me a really big lesson. You know, just follow your nose.
Do what you're passionate about. Because I think people sense that.
They really do. And also, they're not daft. And, you know, if you can have on your bookshelf, you know, something really lightweight next to something weighty, and if you can listen to, you know, enjoy music that's from a really broad spectrum, why on earth would you not be able to accept that from an artist you like? Like, it's just like, I was being really stupid. Like, I was sort of underplaying my own, the people that have followed my career. Like, actually, no, you can credit them with a bit more than that.
And I think one of the most moving songs is Youngblood, and you wrote that, didn't you, about your mum's, which is
that's about my mum and my stepdad. Yeah,
amazing, that song. And thanks.
And I made the whole album with Ed Harcourt as well, who's an amazing singer songwriter, and we're now doing our third album together, and he produced the orchestral album as well.
And is it nice, I mean, I this is why I'm so jealous of people like you, being able to put down in words and write a song about something that's really personal and that means a lot. I'd love to be able to do that. It's amazing when I don't think I'll be useless. Is it amazing? Do you feel how amazing that is doing that? Do you know what I mean? Is it?
I think certainly. I feel very, very, very lucky that I have a creative outlet for anything I'm feeling. So, you know, that's exactly what the kitchen discos have been. I mean, next year I was always going to tour. I was always going to write more songs. But touring the kitchen disco, because there happened to be this global pandemic, which meant we did these gigs from home, which meant I felt connected to people, which meant I wanted to do that, but singing to people. Like, for me, it's so lovely that I can have this sort of continuation of what happened to me in life. And everything I write is like a diary entry anyway. You know, my second album, I've got a friend of mine who I was working with at the time, and he's like, I can hardly listen to it because I was going through a breakup with a boyfriend, and it's all in there.
Yeah.
Like, I can put into it as much or as little of what's my life. And sometimes I think I've written about something that's nothing to do with me, and I listen back to it and I'll be like, oh no, actually that's really obvious experience. What that's about. And but I think you shouldn't underestimate yourself with writing, because it's like a muscle you have to learn how to do. I don't know. I'm not like Dolly Parton, like up at four and writing, you know, four songs before breakfast. I've encouraged it in myself because I'm really inspired with people I work with.
And, right. Okay.
You know, the trick is to always be in the room with someone you think is way better than you, and it'll pull you up. You know,
totally. That's
never,
totally true. Actually,
never the most talented person in any room, and that's like a really good thing. I'm not saying that to put myself down. It's like genuinely help me out. Like, it's really lovely to be around people that are brilliant. What they do really inspires you,
I think. And that's the message to anyone listening, actually. That is what you've got to do, and you never know what you might be able to do if you put your mind to it. So, I've never actually tried to write a song, but
exactly there you go.
Yeah. Well, it's been amazing to meet you, and thank you so much for being on the podcast. And
pleasure.
Good luck with everything, and I'll be coming to see you. I'm going to give you your little soap from the box.
God, your podcast is so flash.
I know, it's not
you
really.
You actually do things.
I do actually do that, but I mean, yeah.
That's amazing.
And I will see you in Leeds at the Kitchen Disco.
Yay.
And everyone go and watch it as well. Thank you, Sophie.
It'll be fun, you know.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my chat with Sophie Ellis-Bextor as much as I enjoyed chatting with Sophie Ellis-Bextor. Genuinely just a lovely person. So thanks so much, Sophie, for doing that. And make sure you catch her podcast, Spinning Plates, now. Coming up, a soap star is back, and it's one of the funniest, most talented people I've met. Catherine Tilsley, who played Coronation Street's Eva Price, is my next guest. And honestly, it's an hour of pure fun and laughs. She tells me loads of stories you would never have heard before, so make sure you tune in. As normal, I'd like to thank David Stevens and the Buffy for their edit and technical wizardry. I will see you in a few days' time. Stay safe.